America's suicide rate is nearly 11 victims per 100,000 people. The New York Times says the rate is almost exactly the same as it was in 1965, in spite of the rise of antidepressant drugs, crisis hotline centers, and better treatment of mental illness. We still haven't gotten much closer to preventing suicide. Scott Anderson reported on some of the fascinating paradoxes of suicide in this weekend's New York Times Magazine in an article called "The Urge to End It." We're intrigued enough to ring up Scott for an interview, but respectful enough to credit him with this segment of Ripped Off from the Headlines. Scott Anderson joins us. Hello, Scott.
Good morning.
I think the big misconception about committing suicide rests in the word commit. It makes it seem like people have a strong commitment to the act, but you document over and over that that's just not true.
That's right. And I probably the first thing that needs to be said is that there's really two broad types of suicide. One is suicide that's rather premeditated, that people have been planning for, you know, weeks or even months, and impulsive suicide. And with impulsive suicide, a majority of them think about it for less than 8 hours, and somewhere around 70% think about it for less than an hour before actually carrying through with it.
Disturbingly, you quote mental health professionals who maybe don't even see that distinction as clearly as you do, because over and over again they say after someone commits suicide, well, we know they were mentally unbalanced. That's called, I believe in logic, a post hoc rationalization.
Yeah, I was very struck by that. As a layman coming to it, there seemed to be an element of circular logic to the whole thing, and because what most of us think of suicide as an inherently irrational act, if someone commits suicide, they routinely perform something called psychological autopsies after the fact, mm-hmm. and invariably, or over 90% of the time, they decide that mental illness is the culprit in suicide.
Ovens, guns, and bridges, those were three things you talk about, three methods of committing suicide, where in every case, just a wee bit more inconvenience between the person who for a second wants to commit suicide and actually committing suicide, and just a little more inconvenience and the suicides drop drastically. You want to talk about any or all of those?
Yeah, well, the first really dramatic example of how it's called means restriction in public health school parlance, how means restriction can actually reduce suicide. It came about completely inadvertently in Great Britain in the 1970s when gas was switched from coal-derived gas, which was very high in carbon monoxide, to natural gas, which is virtually carbon monoxide-free. And up until the 1970s, almost all of England was heated with coal gas. And about 50% of all suicides in Britain were from people, quote, sticking their heads in the oven. It was very easy to asphyxiate yourself with coal gas. With the switchover, it made it almost impossible to kill yourself that way. And over the space of about 10 years when the conversion was completed, the overall suicide rate in Britain dropped by about 30%, and it stayed at that level ever since. So what it proved, really quite inadvertently, was that if you remove one means of people being able to kill themselves, the overall suicide rate would drop really drastically.
And this proves itself over and over again, no matter the method. With bridges, you know, the Golden Gate Bridge is a magnet, and there's always that debate. If we put up some barriers against suicide, well, some advocates say it would help, but other people say not only would it hurt the look of the bridge, oh, what's it matter, they say. If people want to kill themselves, people want to kill themselves. But I think the statistic you quoted was they did a follow-up study, and of people who tried to commit suicide and been thwarted, only 6% went on to kill themselves by another means. And over again with bridges, it shows that just a little more inconvenience, a little higher barrier, and people will not jump off a bridge.
That's right. Yeah, it's a very deeply held notion that that suicide is inevitable. But in fact, yeah, over and over again with barriers being put up, it's shown not just that suicides are eliminated there, but that people don't go somewhere else to commit suicide. There's a really famous case of two bridges virtually adjacent bridges in Washington, D.C., where one was always the kind of the notorious suicide bridge in Washington. And finally, in the 1980s, they put up a suicide barrier on it. And the opposition to it was that this other bridge, it's literally only 60 yards away, an identical drop into this gorge, that people would just go there and do it. But, in fact, people didn't. And that second bridge still doesn't have a suicide barrier up, and the numbers have never changed on that bridge.
Your article ends with talking to this guy named Kevin Hines, who jumped off the Golden Gate Bridge, almost immediately regretted it. He was also in a documentary called The Bridge, which was largely about people who jumped off the Golden Gate Bridge. I have a clip of Kevin from that documentary.
The second my hands left the bar, I said, I don't want to die. I said, what am I going to do? This is it. I'm dead. So I said, well, maybe if I get head or feet first, maybe I'll live.
He's a really effective spokesman. I've seen him do a lot of media appearances. And I don't think before people hear him, they realize that a lot of people regret it instantly.
Yes. I actually talked to four people who attempted suicide who should have died. I mean, the odds were overwhelmingly against them. Two who jumped off the Golden Gate Bridge and two who shot themselves in the head. And all four of them said that the two people who went off the bridge, including Kevin, said the instant their hands came off the railing, they knew they'd made a mistake. And likewise, with the two people who had shot themselves, the moment they regained consciousness or the moment they felt the impact of the bullet, they knew they'd made a horrible mistake.
You never connect the dots, but one of the implications I got from the article was it was sort of an indictment of the mental health community, just as far as the suicide rates haven't budged. You talked to mental health professionals who said, well, they were suicidal. They didn't even know about that gas oven study or incident that you were talking about. Were you disappointed with the mental health community and its attitude towards suicide or its effectiveness?
A little bit. I think that there is this element of myopia within the community of. I mean, I think they come from a standpoint of like looking at something from the standpoint that, well, of course this is a crazy act, so therefore the person has to be crazy. And I mean, I can understand why they, because of their training, they approach it from that angle. My bigger problem with the mental health community is that the idea that everything is almost all suicide is based in mental illness, it kind of raises the question, well, okay, well, where does that get you? Because it's, even if you know somebody is depressed, somebody is bipolar, it doesn't give you any predictive power to figure out who is actually at risk to commit suicide.
Scott Anderson, who wrote a piece in the New York Times called The Urge to End It. Thanks, Scott.
Thank you, Mike.
We're back with the Bryant Park Project from NPR News.